and they eventually go away. So this is all going to be recorded. It's archival quality. It's going to go in the ATIA Archives of Pacific eventually.
Okay.
Whenever I'm done. And then what I do with it is I actually cut up the conversation so discrete topics are there. And I don't do a transcript because when we speak, we don't speak grammatically in any way, shape, or form. So I do a summary of it and then take direct quotes out as we go along. So it's very important, and this is something that Vic and I talked about a lot. This book is not a biography of Vic. It's a story of the time with a guy named Vic Atiyah who played a role in it. And so that's where you can tell me about the times in some very good ways that I can't get in any other way. So that's the whole purpose of this.
Okay.
So you're elected in 1960.
Right,
60 elected,
that's correct.
In 61.
61 was my first session.
Yeah.
And Victor was still in the House
in
61.
That's his second term.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think it was in 63 that he moved to the Senate, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a 64 election he moves over. So he's in the House for three terms.
Okay.
And so right when the Republicans take the majority, he leaves. He doesn't regret going to the Senate, but he was always in the minority his entire career.
Well, during my first session as a freshman legislator, you know, I didn't know a lot of the people even in my own caucus.
Mm-hmm.
And however, during that period of time, the Portland legislators, mm-hmm. Not just the Multnomah County, but the Portland legislators caucused occasionally.
Oh, okay.
And of course, that included Victor partly because of the business being in Portland.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you know, I began to have some conversations with him about legislation, and and frequently we was some. Times were on the opposite side of the issues, and but it was a time when legislators of the opposite party weren't at each other's throat.
Uh-huh.
There was much more civility.
Yeah.
And we used to socialize together.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it was also a situation. Very interesting. My first session, legislators were paid according to what was in the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
$50 a month. And the Secretary of State issued a check for the 2-year period for the 24 months, $1,200. Right at the beginning of our legislative service. And the only expenses that were allowed was one round trip from your district to Salem,
mm-hmm.
and if I'm not mistaken, it was at 6.5 cents a mile or something like that. So there wasn't much money involved.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a result of that, when we socialized in the evenings, you know, usually the lobby picked up the cost of what the dinner and whatever. There was much more rapport between legislators and the lobby at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked for a domestic insurance company,
yeah.
North Pacific Oregon Auto, and the person who was executive vice president at that time was sort of the contact for the company and at the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoyed the association with the legislators. I think he knew practically every one of them.
Yeah.
And I guess that's one of the reasons when I approached him about running for the legislature that he thought it might be a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't my idea. I had previously run for office and not been successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had sort of given up the idea of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I went to work for North Pacific and some of the legislators from the South sub-district, you know, Multnomah County, West Multnomah County with sub-districts, wanted to replace one of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to me and wanted to know if I would be interested in running. And I said, well, I've just, within the past year, gone to work for this insurance company, and I'm sure that they're not going to be interested in allowing me to do it. And, well, they approached the, it was Pete Brooks,
mm-hmm.
approached him, and he said it would be okay. By the way, if I'm not mistaken, Victor was one of the pallbearers at Pete Brooks' funeral. And I was also, but there were only two people from the company.
Yeah.
And I was one, and nephew of Pete Brooks was the other. But I believe, I'm almost positive that Victor was one of the pallbearers at his funeral. So anyway, we, you know, would have gatherings in members' homes, the ones that actually were renting a home or at apartments,
mm-hmm.
and socialize in the evenings. Victor participated in some of that, but not a whole lot.
Yeah.
And
did you get a sense of it because he had homework to do, or he just was?
I think it was
going home, or
yeah, it was going home. I think.
Okay.
That's at least that's a sense I believe that all of us had at the time.
Yeah. He felt that, I mean, with his brothers running the store, he felt an obligation to be back there at least every weekend.
Yeah.
And if he could get up there and, you know,
but even during the week, he would sometimes do that.
Yeah.
And I did the same thing.
Yeah.
I actually was an officer of the company by 1963.
Right.
I was an officer of the company. And I made a lot of trips back and forth, you know, long hours and tiring days as a result of that. And Victor, I did the same kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
When he moved to the Senate, and I'm not sure whether it was right immediately, but I think it could have been, he became the chairman of the Senate Education Committee.
Yeah, it was very early.
And also, at that time, he and I collaborated in having a bill drafted that would set forth what a primary or standard education was for every school district in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't get anywhere because of OEA.
Yeah.
They didn't want that to happen.
Yeah.
They would have lost a lot of influence over things, I think, and it would have been much more difficult for them to do the things that they're supposed to do, I guess. They've been a giant on the scene in Salem for years.
Yeah,
but at that time, there was conversation, you know, about what the state's obligation was, and we felt that if we could actually have legislation on the books that said that these are the things the state are going to pay for, then the local district could make up their mind on what they wanted to add to it.
A rational fiscal policy for schools.
Yes.
An odd idea.
And they knew that the next thing that we were going to try and do, and we had a bill drafted for that, was to centralize collective bargaining for teacher salaries. State of Washington has that.
Yeah.
State of Oregon doesn't, and it's a disaster.
Yeah.
It's a disaster for the teachers, and it's a disaster for taxpayers.
Yeah. And since Major 5, it makes no sense whatsoever.
So about that same time, then, I guess it was the next session, that Victor actually became chairman of revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I got to know him better because I was on the emergency board.
Okay.
And the Ways and Means and the emergency board were in statute at that point in time. And as you know, the presiding officers and the co-chairs of Ways and Means, the chairs of revenue, and then the Senate had one extra person to appoint, and the House had two. And so happens that I was one of the two, even during the Republican era, which was, with my Democratic colleagues, create a lot of suspicion among them.
Now, was Bob Smith the speaker at that point?
Oh, when I was appointed, Monty Montgomery. Yeah,
okay.
Monty Montgomery appointed me to the emergency board, and then he appointed me to the next session. He appointed me to Ways and Means. Mm-hmm. So I was on both the emergency board and Ways and Means. Victor was on. And it was a small group of people.
Yeah.
And we worked together very closely.
Yeah.
You know.
Going back a bit, when you were first in the House, did Vic have the reputation yet for being the revenue guy?
I think that's pretty
It seems
true.
Like by about 63, it's pretty clear. There's another person who retires and Vic kind of steps in.
Because of the businessman.
Yeah, yeah.
He knows about money.
Yeah.
You know, and he's particularly a successful one. And, of course, they were very successful. He did. Most of his, all of his tenure in the House, I think, was under Democratic control.
Yeah.
And revenue, at that time, the revenue committee was pretty heavily Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
There were some Republicans on it, and I'm not sure whether he was on the...
Maybe he was the first term, but the second and third term.
He was.
Yeah. Up there.
Okay.
We have a great thing in the archive from his very first term, whatever committee he's on. They're dealing with the budget that they're going to deal with.
Yeah.
And he takes home his legal pad, and he goes through and does the math and writes a note saying, well, if that's what our intention is, this doesn't add up.
Yeah.
So, you know, as soon as he gets there, he's being a business guy and doing things by hand. And making those
decisions. Yeah, we all did it by hand.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And one of the other interesting things, the woman who was his secretary, in the House, was a longtime Salem person who, that was the thing that a lot of the Salem women did during session, and made themselves available to become secretary, particularly for those who didn't have their wives.
Right.
Many of the members had their wives employed, and that was the way they were able to be there.
Yes.
You know, because of that $50 a month salary.
Still the case to this day.
Yeah. Anyway, and Victor's, wife was not his secretary,
right.
So she came to me, and she said that she knew she had been working since the 30s in the House. And of course, in the 50s, 30s, that's not very long.
Yeah.
Really, a period of time and everything. Had actually worked with my uncle,
uh-huh.
who served in the 33 session from over in Grant and Union County.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was very interesting that she had then ended up working for Victor.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that sort of drew Victor and I together, I think. Strange how those things can affect a relationship. But we really got to know each other really well during the time that he was on the emergency board and I was on the emergency board.
How was he on the e-board? He talks about it as he wasn't asked to come back to the e-board. He says he kept raising his hand and saying, so what's the emergency? It's being, you know, conservative and tight with a nickel about what we're doing here.
And I was that way too.
Uh-huh.
You know, and we didn't always accept what the governor's staff was presenting to us being really an emergency.
Mm-hmm.
The emergency board was really tough.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's one of the reasons that the liberal Democrats didn't like the emergency board being the size that it was. And they fought for enlarging it. One of the persons that was the most outspoken about it was Frank Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And he finally got his way. And I still am one of those people who believes it's very tough for a large committee to make tough decisions.
Yeah.
The smaller the group is, the easier it is for them to make correct decisions.
Exactly.
You don't. There wasn't much back scratching among the members.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do someone a favor and be a vote that got something passed that you really didn't believe in.
Yeah.
And Victor was very strong and adamant in that regard.
So did you find people, when they were on the e-board, were they playing their institutional role?
Yes.
So I'm the ways and means person, I'm the revenue person, I'm the city consultant.
Oh, yes.
So they were playing their institutional roles.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that was the benefit, actually, of having the chairs of revenue serving on the emergency board. Because they brought a different interest to what kinds of actions sometimes we were asked to take. Other funds and federal funds, the emergency board had the authority to raise limitations.
Yeah.
So you could end up creating a program or authorizing a building that was going to cost a lot of money eventually from the general fund if you made a wrong decision.
Yeah.
And it was not real easy for agencies to get that kind of thing passed through the emergency board unless they showed some way that they were going to be able to support it in the future. We were both there during the time that the community colleges really started to boom in the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
And the state provided the revenue for most of the initial building and construction, leaving the local district to do the support of the funding of personnel and program.
Right.
And I don't know for sure how that is, whether it's still that way or not, but I have the sense that it isn't.
No.
And that's a good example of something going beyond where we intended it to go when it was established. But, you know, most of the community colleges didn't even exist at that time. Portland had what was essentially a community college but it was in, I think it was in the Failing Building. Mm-hmm. There, close to the Ross Island Bridge.
Yeah.
And Amos...
D. Bernardes.
Yeah, was the he was an associate superintendent of Portland Schools running that program, but so he was really pushing to have a community college, and a group of us could have been just Ways and Means, but it could have been the Emergency Board too. Stood on the site of where at Mount Solano. When there wasn't a single building,
yeah.
With him, with Amo telling us how it was going to be.
Yes. Very large parking lot. Buildings.
It was sort of funny. But if I'm not mistaken, Victor was in that group.
Uh-huh.
But that would not been unusual, even if he had been a member of the committee that was actually making the visitation. Because the metropolitan legislators were very interested at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, the Portland Community College District goes way into Washington County.
Oh, yeah.
So it could have been just that he was one of the interested legislators.
Yeah.
After
a sideline on that, I live really near the Rock Creek campus, which is where the Washington County Historical Museum archives are.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've gone and looked at all their stuff on Vic. He gave them, they have like 80 awards. He just dumped plaques and trophies. Every time you go on the Rose Festival when you're the governor on the ship, they give you plaques. They got dozens of them.
Yeah.
And he gave tons to the university. It's like, man. So when I talked to Mike Thorne, Mike and Jill, I was talking about that, and they said, oh, you should see our basement.
Yeah.
Same thing. Just amazing.
Yeah. The during the time he became governor after I wasn't there.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, and so I didn't have a lot of contact with him during the time he was governor. I'll leave it to you to whether this is off or on the record.
Mm-hmm.
But I received a call from Jerry that he wanted to talk to me about a piece of legislation affecting domestic insurers.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way down, I tried to recall whether it was after Pete Brooks had retired as president of Oregon Auto or before, but I think it was after, and I think that's probably the reason I got the call rather than Pete to come down and talk to them about it. But anyway, there was an exemption from the premium tax for domestic companies.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a push for money at the time.
If Jerry's around, there must be a fiscal crisis.
You know, it's a situation where he served during a recession that was pretty severe. The dollar amounts might have been different, but the percentages
were worse. They're stunning.
Yeah. Anyway, so they were looking for money. They wanted to see whether there was really any justification for that exemption from the premium tax. And I gave them pretty much the history of it and why, you know, it was actually something the legislature decided on. It was not unusual across the country for legislators to do this, to aid in the development of an industry, the insurance, not only the property and casualty insurance, but also life insurance. were exempt from the premium tax. Anyway, the discussion got around to the point where something needed to be done to stop other companies from forming a company in the state of Oregon to run their things, their business through that to avoid paying the premium tax. And so it was, as a result of that discussion, and I don't know at that point whether there was actually a bill that had passed or and he was considering a veto or whether they were trying to prepare a piece of legislation for the legislature. I rather believe it was probably the latter, that they were in the throes of developing a piece of legislation for the next session of the legislature. Could have been that the legislature was even in session, because after I was there, I didn't go back.
Exactly.
You know.
You're not Roger Martin.
No.
You did not become a lobbyist and just lived there.
No. Well, you know, I don't like that. I don't like the what they do in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And particularly in Washington, D.C., they have access to the members in the cloakroom. And
yeah, as a former member, you get all sorts of good stuff.
See, as a former member, can have the courtesy of the floor extended to me. I've had that, well, I guess the first time was with Denny Jones when he carried the bill naming the House wing after me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's actually the first time after I had served that I was back on the floor of the House.
Wow.
That's amazing, isn't
it?
But, you know, you have your own time, you do what you can do best, and I did that, and I wasn't going to be there second-guessing the other members publicly.
Yeah, exactly.
I did that in the confines of my home.
Right.
But anyway, the legislation was drafted to give an exemption for any company that was formed before a certain date.
Mm-hmm.
And the last company to have successfully formed a domestic company, and it's a large insurer,
mm-hmm.
was Farmers Insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a domestic company that they run their business through to avoid the premium tax. And that was the way the premium tax was protected for North Pacific and Oregon Auto and for Oregon Mutual out in McMinnville. By the way, one of the fellows that I hired and worked for me as an underwriter became president of Oregon Mutual.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Dennis Wilson.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, just so you know, this will probably be on the record.
Okay.
Because they're doing similar types of thinking about repealing the unitary tax.
Oh, okay.
Which they call the special session. And so if the timing on this is right around there, this becomes a real important part of that story.
Okay.
Where we're scrambling for how do we plug in holes. This isn't the safe rate where we say, oh, look, we found $81 million. This is the taxes and how we go about that, in tracking companies, you know, getting the tax system so that we can get through the recession.
Well,
I think it's part of that same story.
I'll leave it to your judgment on whether that is. But anyway, before I left the office, we had pretty well come to an agreement that that was the way to handle it and to stop other companies from coming in and doing what Farmers did. Farmers was the only company that was actually an outside company that got away with doing that.
Yeah.
Everyone else that was protected by that deadline date were companies that had actually originated here in Oregon.
Right, they've been here for a long time.
Been here for a long time. Of course, Oregon Auto and North Pacific have been purchased several times since I left.
Yeah.
and the Safeco now.
Yeah.
And if you notice on, if I don't know whether you're insured by Safeco, but the declaration page for Safeco Insurance does it say Safeco Insurance Company of Oregon or doing business?
I think of Oregon.
Of Oregon. Mm-hmm. It's really North Pacific.
Yeah.
Safeco, you know, it's North Pacific doing business as Safeco Insurance Company of Oregon.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go back to talk about elections and how they work between multiple member districts and single member districts. Let me tell you what Victor said. Victor loved multiple member districts.
Yeah.
He just loved them. He loved representing the dairy farmers. He actually had dairy bills.
Yeah.
He was on the dairy committee for a little while. Then, and that's one reason his archives are Pacific. Because we were his university in his district. It took me a long time to learn.
Washington County, they ran countywide.
They ran countywide, and they had there was a shared one with Yamhill County. He loved that. Then when you go to single member districts, he felt there was a difference in the relationship with his constituents. He felt that they owned him more.
Yes.
His letters got nastier. They were more pointed. Relations with some of the constituents. So, you were part of Multnomah. You're running when Multnomah, after 54, they have the districts in Multnomah.
Right.
And I love those. Basically, two of them were Jim, so they would always be Democrats, and two were Jim, so they'd be basically Republicans. which, when they were seeking to change the single member districts,
the central
was concerned about that.
East Central. And West Side were Republicans.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And South and North and the county districts were all Democrats.
All Democrats, yeah.
Yeah.
What was your experience in running? Did you run on a slate?
No.
Or any of that, or relations with the constituents? How did that work?
Initially, no, and then yes. Mm-hmm. Before it was over, we did both slates and individual campaigning. But when I first ran, and it probably was because there was an incumbent that I was running against, an incumbent that the two other incumbents didn't want any longer. Hal Christopher was his name, and he would. I think he was either part owner or worked in a hardware store.
Uh-huh.
He ended up, he drank too much, for one thing. Before his life was over, and I don't know whether Hal is still alive or not, to be honest with you, but he was driving taxicab.
Wow.
In Portland. It was quite a come down for him.
Yeah.
Anyway, interesting that my total expenditures in that race in 1960 was $500.
Uh-huh.
And there was a lot of shoe leather.
Yeah.
And I knocked on a lot of doors. And I came up with a sort of a tricky way of getting my message out is I put my campaign piece on the outside of a large envelope that the ballots could be stuffed in and the other people's literature could be stuffed in it, and the precinct committee people in the South City sub-district loved those envelopes.
Mm-hmm.
Made it much easier for them to have a piece to hand to the person at the door.
Right.
And of course they hand it to the door and here I am, my picture and my campaign pitch.
Yeah.
Now, some of the other candidates weren't very happy about that. But nevertheless, none of them had thought about doing that.
Right.
And that's what my expenditure was.
Yeah.
was those envelopes and having them printed. And
do you remember people using lawn signs?
Not at that point.
Okay. Victor, in his first campaign, he had never really seen lawn signs. No. And somebody that he worked with suggested, so they went and built them in the garage and painted them. Yeah.
The person who really brought lawn signs to the campaigns was Bob Packwood.
Okay.
As far as the Multnomah County area is concerned.
Yeah.
And from there on, everyone had to have lawn signs of some kind. You know, a lot of people didn't want lawn signs in their lawns, and they were much more resistant to it than they are now.
Yeah. What Vic discovered is it was a good way for, because he got into politics for a variety of things. One of his closest friends, Jim Campbell, was basically saying.
And Jim Campbell, by the way, was one of them. Jim Campbell, I knew very well.
Well,
personally.
I could, because I have Jim Campbell questions for you as well later on.
Jim.
Did the media get involved in your first race at all?
Well, I'll tell him about that. But Jim Campbell was an agent for North Pacific Oregon Auto.
Yeah.
And Tom Galt, his partner.
Yeah.
And anyway, I knew him really well.
Yeah.
Of course, the Oregonian didn't even mention me when they went for endorsements. They didn't say, and so was also running or something. Nothing in the Oregonian about me. And part of that is that, you know, I had worked for Terry Schlunk before this.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I had been Terry's essentially chief of staff when he became mayor.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Oregonian and Terry just were never got along on anything. And so that put a kibosh for me. But
was the Journal writing about you?
The Journal did mention me, but they didn't endorse me. They actually endorsed a fellow that was a longshoreman.
Mm-hmm.
Ernie, what the heck was his last name? Isn't that terrible? I put it out of my mind, but they endorsed Norm Howard, Grace Peck, and as Ernie. But they did mention that I was also a strong candidate. That was all the media had to say about me the campaign. Well, at that point, as you well know, the people who got the top three votes and were nominated, and then they were elected the same way. And getting the nomination, I ran third. And being elected, I ran second. Grace Peck ran first, I ran second, and Norm Howard ran third. You know, that's where my career in government started.
So you said you ran on a slate later on?
Yeah.
Was it just the three Democrats just combining things?
It was essentially the three Democrats combining a piece of literature.
Yeah. That's what Vic did in the 62 election with Bobby Jones.
Okay.
John Mosser.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bobby Jones sat right next to me, and he only served one session.
Yeah. Well, he served 6 months.
Yeah.
And there, you guys had a special session in 63 that was in December, and he was going to be on Naval Reserve duty anyway.
Yeah.
And Hatfield said, so you want to be a judge? And apparently he turned him down the first time, because Hatfield said, Washington County, where you live, is not on Multnomah County, where I work. And it came through. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty amazing. This is in 1964, when Vic moved to the Senate, he took on John Hare. And he won.
Yeah.
And so this is the letter that John Hare wrote.
Oh.
It just on the Senate stationery is basically congratulations.
Isn't
that's
that?
All. Just one line.
That's John Hare.
Yeah.
That's typical John Hare. He had very little to say at any time.
Yeah. So maybe this was loquacious John.
In fact, I'm not sure I ever saw John Hare get up on the floor of the House and say anything.
Oh, yeah. Huh. Because in Washington County, it was seen as the more populous east side is winning out over the less populous west side.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I know John Hare because there's a Hare Field in Hillsboro.
Yeah.
In Vic's first run, one of his big endorsements and the person who gave him money, he only raised, like you, I mean, he raised like $219 his first time.
Yeah.
And spent $138.
Yeah.
But Henry Hagg of Hagg Lake is the one who gave him money.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Things were different.
Things were very different. Things were very different. So talk to me about the switch. So the 72 election, you're going to single member districts. You've got 18-year-olds coming in. People have talked especially about Multnomah County, where the Democrats were reticent to go to multiple member districts. Apparently Betty Roberts went and did the math and said, you know, if we go to multiple member districts, we're gonna get all these seats. There might be one Republican that would win. I don't think a Republican did, but talk about that switch to the single member district races.
Well, it wasn't good for me,
mm-hmm.
and I really didn't support the idea of doing it. But the election ended up with three people in the race.
Mm-hmm.
There was an independent as well as a Republican. And my district was Eastmoreland,
mm-hmm.
and Selwood and the West Side.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up Dunthorpe and Riverdale, try and knock on doors.
Yeah.
You're gonna get, you know, house made of some kind,
yeah.
Not the owner.
Yeah.
And many of those places, at least at that time, and they're so far apart that I actually had a lobbyist arrange a coffee hour, mm-hmm. in Dunthorpe for me at the home of the people who owned and ran Van Dyne Chocolate.
Oh, yeah.
Remember the Van Dyne Chocolates?
Yeah.
Those were really probably the best candy in town.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the Van Dynes had a coffee hour, and that was the way I broke in to the Dunthorpe area. And I actually did reasonably well,
mm-hmm.
believe it or not. I think it was the result of that coffee hour.
Mm-hmm.
But by that time, you know, I was on Ways and Means, and I was on the emergency board,
right.
and the Oregonian, the next morning after the election, said I'd been defeated,
mm-hmm.
and I had a, well, let's see, he probably was 10 or 11 year old son,
mm-hmm.
Getting ready to leave for school, he said, "Don't worry, Dad." He said, "When all the votes are counted, you'll have won." Well, let me tell you, I had gotten the list of applications for absentee ballots,
mm-hmm.
and I'd written each one off them a personal letter,
mm-hmm.
asking them for their support and their vote. And when they counted the absentee ballots, I won by 242 votes. And I, you know, here I am for this area, on both the emergency board and Ways and Means and the Republicans are in control of a house at the time. Now, the 72 election changed that because the Democrats actually ended up winning enough votes to control.
Yeah.
And I was in sort of the mix for the leadership at that time and wasn't successful other than to become Speaker Pro Tem and Chair of Ways and Means. And my chair, my co-chair in the Senate at that time was Bill Holmstrom. And essentially Bill Holmstrom wasn't there most of the time. Bill Holmstrom was at that point drinking more than he should. And as a result, you know, I pretty much had Ways and Means of responsibility for both the House and the Senate. Fortunately, there were some good Senate senators on Ways and Means, like Lynn Newbery, and we worked together very well. And we actually had a good session.
That's why we were still Republican senators. And we get to drop off precipitously after that.
So anyway, I don't think that, to be honest with you, I don't think single member districts have been very good for Oregon. Now I'm sure there are minority groups that would argue with me on it, but I'm not sure that the in multi-member districts that both minority groups wouldn't still have had.
Well, in a lot of ways it would allow, because you know there's been an explosion, especially since 74, an explosion in the number of people who aren't registered as Republican and Democrat.
Yeah.
And it would give space for some of them to be in there.
Yeah.
There were multiple member districts, but we're not going to go back to that. Yeah, Ted Kulongoski, when I was talking to him about that, pairs that with the beginnings of an environmental movement. So Democrats, by 1980 into the mid-80s, you've got to be an environmental side. But that it's just beginning then. So it kind of feeds into single-member districts. You can go, the interest groups can have single issues, and it begins to build on itself.
Was it right at that time that I won that award from... And people didn't believe it, but I won an award from the
Oregon Environmental Council.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Jenny hired Kulongoski as a staff member for the legislature.
There you go.
Before he ran.
Yeah. When he was talking to Gary Wilhelms, he was saying how interesting it was that Ted was the staffer, and then the next term, he was on the committee. But, yeah.
And the very, very interesting thing is I appointed him chair of labor.
Oh, yeah?
And a lot of people thought I had given the store away.
Oh, yeah.
And during the session, he came to me and he said, you know, he said, I'm sitting on some workers' comp bills that the state of Oregon or the businesses of the state of Oregon can't afford. And he said, I'm getting a lot of pressure. And he said, they're going to come down and talk to you. And sure enough, the labor people asked for an appointment and came in and talked to me about it. And I just... told them and said, I believe in a strong committee system. And I said, I appointed a chairman that I thought would be strong. And I said, I will back whatever the chairman feels that is in the best interest of the state of Oregon. And I'm not going to interfere with that.
Yeah.
And he sat on them. They didn't get out and they didn't pass. And, you know, he was so involved then in the solution of the workers' comp problems for the state of Oregon. Then after that, he was, you know, after he was in the legislature, he was the head of the, what was it, finance and industry or something department, they called it, finance and insurance maybe. And it was during that period of time that Goldschmidt called together that group to
solve
the workers' comp problems.
Yeah.
And the workers' comp rates just went way down.
Yeah. And then there were slight problems with that, which Governor Golengoski had worked on fixing in like 2003 and 2004.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah. That doesn't matter. Like I say, left the legislature, I really didn't go back, except when they asked me to.
Right.
And I got that call from Jerry, and we talked about that domestic insurance premium exemption.
Yeah.
And that was about the only contact I had with him during the time he was governor. Had no reason to.
Yeah.
I knew I had. I had a lot of faith in him.
Yeah. Yeah. Those who did, who knew him, did. Just he would not shine. He would not toot his own horn.
That wasn't the way he was.
Yeah. And that worked out for him, but it drove Denny nuts. Gotta take credit for this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
As you're in the House and then moving into leadership, on the Senate side, they've got the coalition.
Right.
Did that have an impact on how you dealt with the Senate, or did that just kind of get things going and then they would go through the legislative session? In 71, it becomes a big deal. Vic is the new minority leader,
yeah.
And it takes them 54 ballots to come up with a president. And so one thing I'm going to talk to you, I already talked to Wally Carson, but I need to go back and talk to him and Tony Meeker, who were in the caucus. The caucus didn't support Vic for being president of the Senate, which is fascinating to me. Lynn Newbery was their guy, and then they kind of switched around. Eventually John Burns gets it. But it's that dynamic, that kind of strange dynamic.
No, you know, I wasn't aware of what really was going on. I kept out of it.
Yeah, which seems to be the safe thing to do.
Yeah.
Vic hated the coalition. But then when he becomes the minority leader, in effect, he has to use the coalition.
Yeah.
So there's a very interesting flip as he goes into explicit leadership.
Yeah. Well, you know, the John Burns thing just came out of nowhere, as far as I was concerned. I wasn't prepared for that at all when that happened.
Yeah.
It would have been better if John had switched parties, you know.
Yeah.
Because essentially he did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. At the end of that session in 71 is when it was all the stuff about the 18-year-old vote.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to Earl Blumenauer has been a hoot on that, because that's his, he's 21 years old at that point, and Wilson Clark's been pushing this. But in effect, the coalition comes back then because they couldn't get it out. They had 15 votes on the 18-year-old constitutional amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually Burns steps in again, and in effect, the coalition asserts itself to get them out of town and get this thing voted up or down. It's just fascinating stuff. Look at it. I will be talking to John as well. See if he sheds light. He wrote some amazing notes to Vic that are just, they're really heartfelt about the position that he was in, helping to preserve Vic's caucus, as well as the sanctity of the office of president of the Senate.
Well, Bud Lent was head of the Democratic caucus.
Yeah, and he was the one they wanted to be the president.
Yeah.
And
Bud Lent actually was a cousin of mine.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. there was one time in the house when Bud Lent and Elmer from Clackamas County was with the, you remember is it, what the name is, Jenny?
I don't, honey.
And then...
if I was at home, I'd have my blue books. I went and borrowed all of them from the
okay.
Who has everything.
Anyway, it was... it was from Clackamas County. But... And Warren... I think it was, his last name was Smith, a Republican from Benton County, and I were in the house, and we were all related to each other.
Oh, yeah.
But all with different last names.
Oh, yeah? Huh. It's kind of like something people still don't understand here. Gordon Smith is a Udall.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and Jim Smith, wasn't it? What is his name?
Jim Simmons was in the Senate.
Uh-huh.
He was a cousin of mine. And then my brother was in the Senate for one.
Yeah,
one session. And that was during the time I was Speaker.
Yeah. So you move into the speakership in 75.
Mm-hmm.
Vic is the minority leader in the Senate.
Right.
Of a minority that is shrinking drastically.
Right.
They had six that time. That's when they took a picture of them all in the phone booth on the second floor. when they have, in 77, when there are seven of them, Vic had little gold Roman numeral sevens made.
Yeah.
I've seen three of them so far.
Yeah.
But did you deal with him as the leader, minority leader in the Senate?
Sure.
When you were...
Yeah.
And so talk to me about that. And the reason, it's not just his legislative stuff. After his 74 defeat in for governor, he is all of a sudden, it's like he's the head of the Republican Party in Oregon.
Yeah.
Even though he lost by a ton, he hits the worst defeat for a governor and gubernatorial candidate since 1950. But in his own mind, he, talking to his son, there was like a Watergate discount. So Watergate, so we didn't lose by as much. And he was just thrilled at meeting people all over the state. And he stepped in. He's the one who's choosing who's going to be the executive director of the Republican Party in Oregon. He's the one who's putting together things where Gerry Ford is coming to town. Rockefeller is coming to town. Reagan's coming to town. In the party, he's all of a sudden a big statewide player. So what was it like working with him as that minority leader position when you were Speaker?
It was pretty routine.
Uh-huh.
And that, in some ways, I guess that also says something about
mm-hmm.
how Victor is.
Mm-hmm.
There was just a job that needed to get done, and when something came up that... there was some coordination that needed to be taken care of. At that point, Joe Smith was my chief of staff, and he would arrange a meeting with Victor, and we'd talk about what it was and come to an agreement, and one way or another, that it was pretty routine. We tried to have a weekly meeting with the governor at the time,
mm-hmm.
and Victor was involved in those meetings
mm-hmm.
Because the Senate being so divided.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether we included the Republican leadership from the House. I think we did in those meetings. The meetings would be in the conference room there in the governor's office.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the heat of a session, you either have to work as a administrator or a manager or an executive.
Right.
to get things done, and so things become pretty routine.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't recall really running into any. Well, it was a fairly short session, that for 75 session. I don't remember running into anything that really was a big issue.
No. It's like there's some clean up from land use stuff.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, but yeah.
It was pretty routine.
Yeah. Okay. Several people have characterized the legislature in the late 60s to about 77-ish as a co-equal part of government. Mm-hmm. You're generating, you know, the big things, the famous things, the bond bill comes out of there, the land use comes out of there,
right.
Those kinds of things. The beach bill comes out of there.
Right.
But it's generating its own ideas, mm-hmm. and you know, McCall buys into them or doesn't buy into them, which is always fun. But that's kind of the last time we see that. The last time we really see that is Kitzhaber and the Oregon Health Plan in the late 80s and early 90s. But since then, the legislature has been basically a reactive body. Did you, at the time, have a sense that you were part of this?
Yes.
Active, you know, important part of government?
In fact, Jason and I talked about us being an equal partner to the executive department. It was our goal to develop the legislature assume that role.
Uh-huh.
A lot of things we did to strengthen the legislature she was, I think, in administration at that time, mm-hmm. and saw the things that we were trying to do. The OLIS project, you know, the information mm-hmm. project, I have, in hindsight, some misgivings about what we did, but, you know, but I think that's normal.
Yeah.
The building of the wings was to strengthen the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
We strengthened the administration committee. We strengthened the each one of the supporting groups, the legislative council and fiscal and those staffs are probably equal to or better than the staff that the governor's office has
mm-hmm.
in the Department of Administrative Services.
Yeah.
I don't think they're being used the way they should be, probably.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. Have become more reactive. That's one thing. I was highly criticized by, I guess it was the one Willamette Week, for not having a program that I was pursuing as an individual, and I didn't have one. And part of the reason that I didn't, I felt that my job was to see that things ran as smoothly as possible. And I believe strongly in the committee system that we have in Oregon. And I believe strongly in the way we handle our budget, agency by each one individually coming to the floor. They do it in caucus, and they settle their budget in caucus in Washington, and it's one or two bills at the most.
Yeah.
Now,
we've gone more that way here, too.
I see.
I don't even go down anymore, because everything's, the major stuff is all in caucus.
Yeah.
More powerful. Did Victor share that same kind of view about the way committees were the important players?
I think he did. You know, I can't recall that we specifically talked about it, but I know that his actions were such that would lead me to believe that was the case.
Yeah, because there's a great continuity with that, and then the way he as governor ran the agencies.
Uh-huh.
A tremendous, wonderful way of giving responsibility. And
yeah, you delegate, and if someone isn't living up to it, you replace them.
Yeah. Although he had a hard time doing that sometimes. Not saying Lee Johnson or anything, but
yeah. But that's what you should do.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
That's what I did with my committee chairman. And you know, one of the interesting things is during the time that Bob Smith was speaker, Bob and I came to the house in 1961.
Yeah.
And he was the only one that was younger than I.
Oh yeah.
And Fadley, if I'm not mistaken, Fadley is like one day older than I. So,
that's wonderful.
But Bob Smith's the only one younger. But mm-hmm. we became really good, close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And during the time I was that he was speaker, the 4 years that he was speaker, mm-hmm. I chaired the subcommittee on education and ways and means, where all the money is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, occasionally, he'd ask me to come to the Republican caucus and talk about things, and I know that some of the Republicans were a little antsy about it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, here's a Democrat that you have sent to fit to be handling all this money mm-hmm. and policy,
mm-hmm.
you know, because the person that controls the purse strings controls policy.
Oh, yeah.
The policymakers sometimes don't like that.
Exactly.
But that is a fact.
Yeah.
And so, I consider that, you know, probably one of the real compliments and honor of my trustworthiness and ability for him to have done that.
Well, Bob was such an interesting speaker. I talked to Paul Hammond a couple of weeks ago. And he was telling me the saga of the bottle bill.
Yeah.
You know, where Bob voted against it, and then he sent it back to committee. And then Bob just said to him, okay, I'm going to stand to the side, and you, whatever happens, happens. And Paul said, you mean I get to appoint who I want to the interim committee? Whatever happens, happens. It was just fascinating.
Yeah.
When Bob went to Congress.
Right.
Because sometimes he was really partisan in the Oregon legislature, and then sometimes he wasn't.
Yeah.
It was very interesting to do that. But when he was in Congress, his staffers here in Oregon, he didn't really pay attention to party registration. And then Greg Walden came in and fired all the Democrats. And Greg Walden had been the one who was kind of known as the nonpartisan guy. So it's just fascinating to look and see how just things go back.
Yeah.
Honey, tell Jim the story about the bill that you got out of committee.
Oh.
With Bob.
We had a bill dealing with tax conservation and supervision commission in Multnomah County. You know, they had that commission
mm-hmm.
in Multnomah County for. They didn't have to publish the budgets of the various governmental agencies within the county like they did in every other county.
Yeah.
The small newspapers throughout Oregon, the only way some of them survive is through that law.
Get the thing there, yeah.
That requires that publication. Well, this commission wasn't doing its job, and after I took a real close look at it, they really didn't have the right authority to either send a budget back or make changes.
Right.
Anyway, and part of that came about because Ross Morgan was very interested in that, and for some reason, and probably because of being out in Gresham, and Gresham had to submit their budgets to the Tax Supervising and Conservation Commission.
Yeah.
Anyway, we had the legislation drafted, and it was a Senate bill, and it was sitting in the Senate committee. They had had no hearings on it, and we were getting down to the final days of closing, where rule suspension was going on to get things done. I wrote a note to the chairman of the Senate committee and asked if there was any possible way. By then Ross was gone because he had been appointed as employment, remember? Anyway, Ross was gone by that time. It was during the session that he actually was appointed at employment, and that was an interesting story, and you probably have heard it. It was the day after Ross Morgan had clobbered Vern Cook at some kind of evening event, which I'm sure both of them had plenty to drink. But Ross floored him, and of course the word went throughout the institution immediately. And then Tom offers him the job as the director of employment, and Ross took it. But getting back to this bill, I wrote this note, and it was Harry Boivin, it couldn't have been more than half an hour. I got a note back from Harry, and he said, the committee, I called a committee meeting. The committee met, and the bill has been passed out of committee without recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And I had pointed out to him this bill only affected Multnomah County,
right.
You know. So it passed the Senate, mm-hmm. even though it came to the floor without recommendation. No one other than Multnomah County people really were interested in it. So it was almost absolutely a new pass. Well, by the time it was ready to come to the House, we were down to the final one or two days. Things were really, really moving. I went up and talked to Bob, and I said, this bill is going to be coming over from the Senate. And I explained to him briefly what it was, and that it only affected Multnomah County, and that I would really not like it to go to committee. And so I said, when I hear the reading clerk mention that the bill has been received from the Senate, I said, I would like to have the bill, and I would then under propositions and motions get up and move for suspension, and that the bill be put before us for third reading and final passage. I said, that's fine with me. He said, sounds like a deal. So anyway, he gave me the bill, took it back to my desk, and when I had an opportunity, I got up under propositions and motion and moved suspension of the rules before us for third reading and final passage. So, brief discussion about what it did, and no one got up to talk about it one way or the other because it hadn't been in committee, so no committee members knew much about it, and they didn't even think about it. I mean, halfway through the roll call, Wally Carson gets up out of his chair and he goes up to Bob Smith and he says to Bob, he said, "Do you know what's going on?" He said, "We've got to stop this." And Bob said, "Calm down, Wally. I know what's going on. Lang has talked to me about this and I said it was okay. Go down." But he, for some reason, he had checked the calendar.
Yeah.
You know, and he had seen it hadn't gone to committee.
Yeah.
Actually, that incentive was a pull away from committee of a bill, and that never happens.
Yeah.
You know. So he came back to me, Wally came back to me, and he says, "How many more of these are there?" He figured there was a real conspiracy going on.
Had a little sack of paper on your desk and said, "Well, I don't know."
But anyway, the bill passed and, of course, was signed. Yeah. And the commission has had, you know, became much more important.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Two last questions.
Okay.
First, it'll be either quick or not. Did you know Jerry Thompson in the insurance business?
Yeah. You know, occasionally the insurance people would get together on things.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working, you know, in the health insurance business.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And we didn't meet with them very often, but we did occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
And because of my being an officer of the company, I always was included in those meetings. Yeah, I knew her.
They didn't talk to you about her?
No.
Okay. It's somewhat of a mystery how
she got the job.
And same thing, because 1978 he hired Carol Whitney as the campaign manager. And also, not clear, he did things by gut feeling a lot. Yeah. And he talked to both of them for like an hour and a half. And then a couple of days later, called back and said, "I want you to have the most important job." And
she couldn't turn it down.
We're just trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
So just seeing it, seeing what's out there. Last thing, Victor ended up being very close to the tribes, especially the Mormons. I trace it back, actually, talking with Bruce Bishop at the old gathering. Victor was the one who pushed through the legislative tribal committee in 73. But trying to figure out, so why did he do that? Do you know anything earlier than that of Victor and the tribe?
No.
Okay. There's a hypothesis that it might be Sam Johnson.
Yeah, it almost had to be Sam because Sam was very outspoken about the tribes.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sam actually sold that one mill to the Warm Springs with a deal of staying, sort of staying on as a manager for the first 5 years.
Right. Martin puts. They saved his bacon.
Yeah.
But
you know.
But you would think Sam Johnson.
I think it was Sam.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it was very interesting to me that the R's never put Sam on Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
And when I became speaker, I called Sam and asked him if he would serve on Ways and Means. And he actually had tears.
Oh, yeah.
You could tell the way his voice was. He said, "You know," he said, "the Republicans never asked me to do that."
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting, just aside from all this.
Yeah.
But he was very, very committed to some kind of tribal recognition. Was also very interesting that on the way to Sam Johnson's funeral, we decided to stay at Canada and then drive on to Redmond from Kaneda. Victor was at Kaneda.
Uh-huh.
Stayed overnight at Kaneda on his way to Sam Johnson's funeral. And so we saw Victor and his wife there.
Mm-hmm.
But so I know they were fairly close.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was really close to Sam for a whole lot of other kinds of reasons. And at one point I was actually thinking about possibly quitting my job and continuing to run for the legislature because being the underwriting officer for an insurance company is a big load.
Yeah.
You know, and he said, if you decide to do that, he said, I'll buy you an insurance agency to run.
Mm-hmm.
That's how close we were.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that was sort of the kind of guy that Sam was, and I think that he and Victor had a very close relationship. Betsy should know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's just there's people like Betsy, Jackie Winters, Paul Phillips, Len Bergstein, who ran both of Strom's campaigns. You had to wait for the session to be over. So they're, I'm figuring they're now kind of calmed down and I can go and talk to them.
Oh, yeah. Well, no point of. There's nothing we can do with what they've done.
Oh yeah, no, it's
I don't agree with. I don't agree with very much of it, but
yeah,
you know, it's the same thing that goes on in Washington D.C. No one looks at the end game and how much it's going to cost and what it's going to do to our economy.
Yeah, yeah.
We're going to become just as socialized as Europe.
Yeah. And there's good ways to do that if you want to do that, but we're not thinking of the good ways to do it, and
no.
We're just kind of ad hoc falling into things.
Yeah.
It was just 2 weeks ago I went through and put together a list of Vic's principles, as he always said. In fact, Jerry, when the Rajneeshis were going, the economy was falling apart, she asked him, how can you sleep at night? I'm not sleeping at all. And he said, oh, I sleep like a baby. And she thought to herself, you son of a bitch. I said, I just go with my principles. And so some of the most fascinating things about him as governor and as legislator, when those principles clash. So the bottle bill is a classic thing. Principle, do what's right for Oregon. This is clearly the right thing to do. Principle, have the least government you can.
Mm-hmm.
So it collides with, so we're putting this on the grocery stores. In effect, farming out government to them. And he eventually voted for it, but it was a long, hard process. And so those the clash of principles that he held really closely was just a fascinating thing.
And they gave the supervision of it to the Liquor Commission.
Yeah, exactly.
And I had dealt with that for 13 and a half years afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I was talking to Mike Thorne because another thing, the lottery is approved in '84.
Yeah.
And so Vic opposed that the whole way, but it's approved. So it's just for economic development.
Right.
And here's what economic development means. And then when I was talking to Ted Kulongoski, he said, yeah, but you know, I was the Attorney General who ruled that it's also this and this. And Mike Thorne made a real good point because he was the head of the committee. So this is coming through. He said, you know, no one has ever defined it. It just depends on who's sitting there at the time.
Yeah.
And so now the lottery is, it's still, I mean, it's not a huge amount, but it's like 7-10%. It's just locked into the budget. And Victor hated that. Collision of his principles.
Yeah.
No, I'm going through there.
Yeah. I would have opposed it too.
Yeah.
For that very same reasons. Yeah, it's dedicated funds are very difficult to deal with and make it budgeting very difficult for the simple reason that either agencies or like economic development get treated differently than everyone else.
Yeah. And Vic during the recession was torn because he knew we needed to beef up economic development. So their budget was like the only thing that was increasing. Higher ed, he knew, was a part of that, and so he's at least able to keep it neutral, which was in effect an increase given the way everything else was being cut.
Right.
But at what point then do you say, okay, we're on a good setting now, and so we have to go back so you guys are regular? It wasn't until this last 2 years that was finally.
The other thing that the lottery has done is it's allowed many casinos.
Yeah.
And they're illegal in Oregon except the tribal ones.
Yeah.
But.
And whenever there's opposition,
you tell me what. Tell me what.
It's not the local people; it's the other tribes.
Yeah. Dottie's, is, for example, is a casino.
Yeah.
They could not exist.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for that, the Restaurant Association would not be nearly as effective as the legislature if the lottery was not out there.
When you were talking about the little newspapers that got by with all the publications, that's exactly what I was talking about. Yep. Thinking in my head is there. That's convenience stores.
Yep.
From the entire state.
Yep.
Lottery.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
So, any last things on Victor?
Well, not
just for someone who thought they wouldn't have much to say.
Not.
I've got to tell you, it's been like an hour and a half.
I'm sorry. I'm inclined when I start talking about things like that and talking more than I should, I guess. Nothing more than to say that I, because of my association with him at the legislature and then the short experience with him as governor, I learned to honor and respect the man, and I think that he made a substantial contribution to the state of Oregon. I felt so strongly about my relationship with him that I couldn't attend the funeral service in Salem.
Yeah.
And I felt bad about that. Jenny went.
I've got the DVD if you'd like to see.
Yeah, I might like it. But I just wasn't sure I was up to at that point. There were some other things that were on my mind, and I just wasn't sure that I wanted to be in public under those circumstances.
Yeah, he's been gone a year, and there are still times.
Yeah.
And the last time I was talking, I talked to his nephew who runs the Tia Brothers.
Yeah.
And his son last week.
Yeah.
And the son is not. He's not very much like Victor. He's very much like his grandfather. I mean, he looks like his grandfather. But the nephew, his personality is like his father and his other uncle, but he has the same emotional connection that Victor did.
Okay.
And both him and then another person I interviewed at the store had been hired by Victor 42 years ago. And a lot of emotions coming up there.
Yeah.
He's just he was an amazing guy.
Yeah, he was.
Whose father was convicted of a federal crime.
Well, you know.
Well, you know.
There are interesting things in the background of a lot of our lawmakers. And,
oh, yeah.
Ed Whelan had a serious thing in his background in connection with what happened to his father.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't know that.
Yeah. Well, and there's Monty Montgomery, who's a very close friend of Vic's.
Yeah.
I haven't traced through exactly what the results were, but he should have gone to jail.
Yeah.
There's no doubt he should have gone to jail. So in Vic's first two sessions, he kept every note that you guys would pass around.
I never did.
Just a gold mine. And my Montgomery is a sleazeball. There's just no doubt that he's a sleazeball. Whatever he is as a legislator, things like that, just personally, he's just not that straight a guy. Nope, and it does. Just comes out in the notes. Ed Fadley's note is fantastic because he comes in with you. And at some point, Vic gets up and there's a bill and he's talking on it. And so the note from Ed Fadley just defines their relationship forever. Don't you ever dare presume to speak and know what I'm thinking. It's just classic. And you know, with presidents of the Senate, that same relationship is going on. But yeah. It's there from the beginning. From the beginning. So it's just fascinating to when I teach my students, it's so hard for them to think all politicians are the same. It's like, well, you're in a system and you're doing things by the same set of rules. But the personality side is something you have to pay attention to. It's always, how do you get to that majority plus one? And it's systemic, it's personal, it's all those things at the same time.
It is, there's no question
about
it.
Throw in partisanship and you got a real...
Lots of things go on behind the scenes. I don't have a record of any of that.
He only did that for the first two sessions. Then after that, the ones he kept were the ones he was proud of.
Okay, and I didn't save any of them. And let me tell you, I did something. I actually was separated from my wife at the time that I... moved out of the speaker's office. And I moved 42 packing cases of material. And they were in a room at the apartment that I was living in. And I finally looked at them and I said, what the heck do I need or want these things for? And they went in a dumpster. When Tom Vaughn found out about that, he went ballistic.
I can imagine.
Because all the records of 18 years,
they're gone. Barbara Roberts was talking about when Frank died, May he just moved into his office and started cleaning it out. And Barbara didn't find out until like 3 or 4 days later she came in and Frank's stuff was out in the hall. And so there's no way of knowing what may be tossed. Whereas Paul Hanneman very proudly has not only all his stuff, but he has the original filing cabinets because they were changing filing cabinets. So he has them set up a lot of dust in there.
Oh. Paul was the senior member of the House when I was Speaker.
Yeah.
And, you know, you always have the senior member do the motions to adjourn and everything. So, yeah, I worked out a signal that he would see and get up and move to adjourn.
Yeah. Fun stuff in there. Yeah, I talked to Harding Myers, looked up forever and ever, and because he succeeded you,
right?
And coming in, so just fascinating stuff with all of that. But the funniest thing is talking about an 82 when they went in and they took the $81 million from Satan. All the things that happened with that. And so I said to him, so tell me about the safe raid. And Hardy, always a gentleman, can't we call it something else? And the best story about the safe raid was Ted Kulongoski, who was in the middle of the gubernatorial. called a special session to do that.
Yeah.
And so Ted votes for it, and so it happens. He's the attorney general when they finally have to pay him that. $81 million becomes some huge $270 million, $260 million check for people to pay that.
Well, you know that Hatfield was trying to develop a deal in Eastern Oregon for the development of a plant for Boeing. That was his pitch to the legislature, and I opposed it from the very first day, and spoke against it. And I was one of us, probably about ten votes initially that opposed it, until people began to realize what was being done, and the use of those veterans funds. It was an illegal use of them.
Yeah.
And eventually the state had to pay that back.
Yeah.
And that got internal politics really.
Oh. Yeah.
It was very interesting.
Yeah.
Hatfield even brought Wayne Morris out to try and convince the legislature that they should support expanding the operation at Boardman.
Yeah.
And you know, if you've ever driven in that country, it's a bunch of sagebrush.
Yeah.
You know, trying to picture a plant for Boeing out there is rather, I don't know whether it's how he came up with that as a
economic. Kind of a Hanford plant. We will build a village.
Yeah.
Out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, at the time that all this actually finally happened, I sat on the middle aisle in the House, about halfway back. And I told my secretary, I said, if you don't want to be really embarrassed, you won't come in. Morris was going to speak right after lunch.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you won't come in. And she said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, you can go to the balcony or somewhere else and watch. I brought my coat in and put it in the chair. And when Wayne Morris got up to start speaking, I stood up, very deliberately put my coat on, and walked back on the center aisle and out the door. Wayne Morris was livid.
I can imagine.
Probably 6 months later, we were having a Democratic function in Coos Bay, and Morris was scheduled to speak, and Charlie Brooks was, his assistant. And Charlie came to me and he said, do you have an electric razor with you? And I said, oh, yeah, but why? He was fine. And he said, well, the senator needs to shave before he appears. And I said, do you mean to tell me that I'm going to give this my electric shaver to the senator who really won't even speak to me? And Charlie said, I guarantee you, he will personally thank you for it. And he did.
Uh-huh.
I gave him the shaver, and later that day, Morris came up to me and he said, thank you for loaning me your razor. So I broke the ice.
Yeah,
it was fun.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. You're welcome.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah.
Just telling you, context is everything. So I discovered that as trying to figure out why Vic got into politics,